Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. And as a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your host for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Mary, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Understanding Adjuvant Therapy for Early Stage Lung Cancer. This is such an important program, and I have to say it's the first time we've offered this particular topic on one of our teleconferences. So we're really very delighted with your response to the program and to be able to offer this, and our hope is to be able to do this again in the future as well. Today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations. And it's really because of that collaboration that we have reached so many of you on the call today. We have over 517 participants on the call today. And you come from all over the United States. You come from large cities and small cities. You come from suburban areas as well as rural and frontier communities. And we also have international participants from Egypt, Canada, China, and the United Kingdom. So you really come from all over the world. And it's a credit to you that you're spending the next hour with us to learn all about early-stage lung cancer. And I'd like to turn your attention to the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials is an outline our speakers have prepared. And there also is information about all of the different collaborating organizations with their websites and their toll-free numbers to have as a resource for each of you. We also have in your materials an evaluation form. And I would ask you each to take a moment at the end of today's program and complete that evaluation form. When you think about it, who but each of you can best tell us the topics you would like us to offer moving forward? This is the beginning of a new year, and as such, we're planning many programs. And so the timeliness of your recommendations couldn't be better. So please do tell us what you'd like us to do. Indeed, this particular topic is one that has been requested for a long time, and we're very delighted to be able to offer it. So tell us what you'd like, and we'll try very hard to implement your suggestions. Now, today's program is supported by an educational grant from Sanofi Aventis US LLC to National Lung Cancer Partnership, Research to Practice, and Cancer Care. And we're very grateful for that support. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I would like to start by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Joan Schiller. Dr. Schiller is Chief Division of Hematology and Oncology. She's also Deputy Director of Simmons Comprehensive Cancer Center, Andrea L. Simmons Distinguished Chair in Cancer Research, University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center. As you can see, Dr. Schiller wears many hats, and she is going to address overview of early-stage lung cancer, the role of adjuvant therapy, including types of adjuvant therapy, and clinical trials. Dr. Schiller?
Hi, Carolyn. So thank you very much for that kind introduction. As Carolyn said, I'm going to talk today about adjuvant treatment for lung cancer. So adjuvant treatment is a term for a treatment for patients whose cancer has been resected. So as we all know, patients with lung cancer who have an operation will often be cured with that operation. However, we also know that lung cancer will come back in some patients despite the fact they had their cancer removed with surgery. So adjuvant therapy is based on the principle that some patients who undergo an operation for cancer will have it recur, despite the fact that the surgeon, who probably did an excellent operation, said they, quote-unquote, got it all. Presumably, in those cases, either the cancer spread before the operation or the surgeon left a couple of cancer cells behind, cells which were simply too small to see. Now, unfortunately, we don't know which patients have indeed had all their cancer removed and which patients have had several cancer cells left behind, since none of our CAT scans or blood tests are good enough to detect microscopic amounts of cancer. So for those patients who we think are at high risk of a recurrence, or of having had some cancer cells left behind, doctors sometimes give chemotherapy after the operation just in case that in fact happened, that there were some cancer cells that escaped or that were left behind. And this practice of using chemotherapy to kill cancer cells that we think are still out there but don't know for sure is called adjuvant chemotherapy. And again, the purpose is to increase the chance of cure following an operation. Now, adjuvant chemotherapy is already commonly used in patients with other types of cancers, such as breast cancer or colon cancer. For patients with breast or colon cancer who are at high risk of having a recurrence. But it wasn't until the past 5 years or so where we've shown that that the same is true for lung cancer, that giving chemotherapy for patients who are at high risk of having a recurrence would reduce the chances of having the cancer come back. Because this is a relatively new finding, many physicians might not know this, that if you've had a lung cancer resected, be sure to ask your physician if you might be a candidate for adjuvant therapy. Now, the type of treatment that is usually given for adjuvant therapy is chemotherapy. And chemotherapy is a word for medications that kill cancer cells. They are usually given intravenously, sometimes orally, but mostly intravenously. Because they're injected into the bloodstream, the chemotherapy circulates around throughout the whole body, every place the blood goes. And so, at least in theory, cancer cells anywhere in the body would be exposed to the chemotherapy. So, how do oncologists decide which chemotherapy to use? Well, the way drugs are developed in oncology in general is that these drugs are usually tested first in patients who've had more advanced disease. If one knows they work in the hardest-to-treat patients, it would make sense that they would work in patients who've had only a couple of cancer cells, the best prognosis patients. In other words, patients who've had their majority of their cancer removed with surgery. Most of the clinical trials and most of the drugs which have been completed to date have used chemotherapy regimens which are approved for use in patients with more advanced disease. And so one of my colleagues, Dr. Heather Wakely, will be telling you a little bit more about some of these in a few minutes. I do want to talk about a couple points that I think deserve a reality check, so to speak. And one is that realistically, adjuvant chemotherapy doesn't always work. Some patients who get adjuvant chemotherapy will have the cancer come back regardless for reasons that, frankly, we don't understand. It might be because the chemotherapy didn't actually get to the cancer cells, or it might be that the cancer cells are resistant to chemotherapy. But nonetheless, the data that we have to date has shown us that adjuvant chemotherapy does decrease the chance of a recurrence and thus increase the chance of cure. The second point is that many patients who have had an operation for cancer may indeed already be cured. Hopefully the cancer did not escape prior to the operation and no microscopic amounts of cancer cells were left behind. These patients, in fact, are indeed already cured and don't need additional treatment. Unfortunately, as I said before, we don't have any scans or blood tests which can determine which patients have residual tumor cells following their operation and therefore could benefit from additional treatment, and which patients do not. So when it comes to receiving adjuvant therapy, it is important that patients talk to their doctor about their risk of having the cancer recur versus the side effects of therapy. If patients are at a low risk of having the cancer recur, meaning that the tumor was very small to start out with and did not spread to any lymph nodes, then the side effects of additional treatment may not be overweighed by the possible benefit. On the other hand, if the patient is at a high risk of having the cancer recur, meaning that maybe the tumor was large to begin with or had already spread to some lymph nodes, then the side effects of chemotherapy may be outweighed by the benefits. I'd also like to point out that there are several clinical trials going on now which look at different medications in addition to the standard chemotherapy drugs. Clinical trials are studies in which patients often receive a new treatment in addition to the standard treatment. So in this case, the standard therapy is chemotherapy. And some of these trials are trying to determine if some of the new drugs that are being developed will improve the chance of cure when combined with standard chemotherapy. These medications are sometimes called targeted therapies because unlike chemotherapy kills both normal cells and cancer cells indiscriminately, These therapies often target things which are specific for tumors. For example, a drug study going on in the United States right now involves the use of chemotherapy plus a drug called bevacizumab. Bevacizumab, which also the trade name is Avastin, is a very exciting drug which kills new blood vessels which are feeding cancer cells or are feeding tumors. In other words, bevacizumab is designed to choke off the blood supply to these tumors. And Dr. Wakely, who's going to be speaking after me, is a physician who is leading this national trial, which will involve about 1,500 patients. We don't have time to go into a lot of detail about the differences in types of clinical trials, but for adjuvant therapy, most of the studies which are going on are called randomized phase 3 studies. And what that means is that in order to scientifically prove that the new treatment, when combined with chemotherapy, is better than the standard treatment, some patients have to get the standard treatment, and some patients get the standard treatment plus the new treatment. And the reason why that is done is because scientifically, it's the only way of being able, 5 or 10 years from now, to look back and make sure that the study was conducted with the highest scientific standards. Because otherwise, some physicians sometimes can be a little bit biased in terms of who they want to give new drugs to. They may decide that only young patients should get a new drug or only healthy patients or something like that. And we want to be very unbiased in terms of these new treatments. So these new clinical trials will often randomize patients to get the standard adjuvant therapy or the standard adjuvant chemotherapy plus one of these new drugs, such as bevacizumab. I just want to conclude by saying that if anyone does want additional information about this topic, there is a patient education program on the website of an organization called the National Lung Cancer Partnership. So to get to that link, one goes to the National Lung Cancer Partnership website, and there it's nationallungcancerpartnership.org. It's all one word. When you get to that website, you can look under Living with Lung Cancer, and you will find it under Educational Materials. So with that, I'd like to stop and turn it back over to you, Carolyn.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Shilla, for just an excellent, very comprehensive and informative presentation and really really excellent description of the role of adjuvant therapy. Thank you very much. And our next speaker is Dr. Heather Wakely. Dr. Wakely is Assistant Professor, Department of Medicine, Division of Oncology, Stanford University, Stanford Cancer Center. And Dr. Wakely is going to address managing side effects and questions to ask your healthcare team about adjuvant therapy as well as about clinical trials. Dr. Wakely?
Thank you very much. It's great to be on this call. So Dr. Shiller did an excellent job of describing why we give chemotherapy after surgery. And I think most people, as they think about chemotherapy, tend to go into that with a lot of fear of the side effects. Unfortunately, in the media, when people talk about patients getting treatment for cancer, it tends to be made fairly dramatic. And I think overemphasize some of the toxicity. So I wanted to address those head on. The main side effects that people deal with chemotherapy include fatigue, lowering of blood counts, which can cause low red blood cells, known as anemia, low white blood cells, which can potentially put people at risk for infection, nausea with potential for vomiting, and everyone is, of course, afraid of losing hair, potential for rashes, and then the ideas about whether people need lines or metaports put in. And so I wanted to address each of those head on and talk about what are the things that people can do to help relieve those symptoms and what can they talk to their healthcare providers about. Fatigue, I think, remains one of our biggest challenges for patients coping with getting chemotherapy. What I encourage patients is the understanding that the chemotherapy that we're talking about in this adjuvant setting or the chemotherapy given after surgery for early stage lung cancer, that chemotherapy is only given for about 3 months. And in studies that have been done, it's shown that while many people starting that chemotherapy are still recovering a little bit from surgery, the chemotherapy and the fatigue that comes from it really only prolongs that recovery by that time period, by that 3 months. And then afterwards, people go on to have a full recovery of their energy in most cases. During the time of treatment, what I encourage my patients to do is to get enough rest, not to nap too much during the day because that does end up increasing fatigue, to still get up and try to get some exercise every day. And with that and the understanding that it's for just a short time, people are able to get through. For the blood count problems, particularly the lower red blood cells with anemia, that is something that also tends to be a bit of an issue for some people during treatment but gets better. If it gets to be a significant problem, we are able to offer blood transfusions. And I encourage people to change their diet to increase the iron that they're eating. With the low white blood cells that can put people at risk for infection, again, it's very rare for someone to have a significant infection during chemotherapy, but it is what we as physicians fear the most. And so we encourage people to have a thermometer at home and to check their temperature if they're not feeling well. We also recommend some diet changes, mostly to avoid raw meats, raw fish, and to wash any fruits and vegetables quite well. But otherwise, it's just a matter of being safe and also, of course, washing hands, being very, very cautious about washing hands. The nausea and vomiting is where we've made the most, I think, inroads in improving symptoms for patients in the last few years. There's really been a significant increase in the number of medications and types of medications we have available to treat nausea. And so we're now at a time where the chemotherapy regimens that when they first came out 20 years ago required us to hospitalize patients to control those symptoms can now be given as an outpatient. So my patients will come in, they'll receive chemotherapy, they will get the anti-nausea medications, they'll get prescriptions to take additional anti-nausea medications for several days afterwards, and most of them never need to come back for any additional intravenous fluids, are able to eat a regular diet. I mean, it's really been a quite remarkable improvement in the last few years. So I let people know not to be particularly fearful about that and not to be afraid to let their doctor know if they are having problems. We don't expect patients to have significant nausea or vomiting, and if I hear that one of my patients was having problems, there are other medications that we can work with. And so that has really ceased to be a big problem. For the hair loss issue, we fortunately also have made improvements in that we now have some chemotherapy drugs that don't necessarily cause hair loss. Now, those aren't going to be the right medications for each patient, and as Dr. Schiller mentioned, we have a variety of chemotherapy drugs to choose from, and the choice of drug is really a discussion between each individual patient and their physician. But the discussion about hair loss and how important that is for each individual can certainly be a part of that discussion. And when we have choices, we can often now choose regimens where hair loss is not a significant problem. There's usually some thinning. The good news, of course, is, too, that even if someone does have hair loss, that hair does regrow after a period of a few months and often comes in even thicker than it was to begin with. The last couple of things I wanted to talk about from a side effect perspective were rash. So skin rashes do happen with certain chemotherapy medications, and what we need to do for that are usually just topical lotions and creams that can keep it under control. Occasionally we'll give medications known as steroids, of which Decadron and prednisone are a couple of types, and those can help control the rash. Another issue that some patients face is difficulty having IV access. So in order to give chemotherapy, we do need to start intravenous lines, which go directly into the blood vessels. I think most people are familiar with IVs. For many patients who have had a surgery and are going to be getting the chemotherapy afterwards for early stage lung cancer, they're only going to need the chemotherapy 4, maybe 8 times. And so most of my patients don't actually need to have a permanent IV line placed because it's only going to be 4 to 8 times that they're receiving chemotherapy. For some patients, though, they do have difficulty having IVs placed for various reasons related to their particular veins. And in those situations, there are a couple of choices. One is called a metaport or a port, which requires a minor surgery to be placed. And it can be a relatively permanent thing, which can then, of course, be removed after the surgery, with additional surgery after the chemotherapy has been completed, I should say. Another option is something called a PICC, or a peripherally inserted central catheter, PICC. Those are long IVs which are started really in the elbow region, and then they have a very long component that brings the chemotherapy in towards the larger blood vessels. And those lines can stay in for several months at a time. They require care on a weekly basis, which can be done with a home nurse. And the good thing is when you're all done with your 3 months of chemotherapy, they can just be removed in the doctor's office. They don't require a surgery. And so for patients that have IV access problems, we usually will go with that. So those are the major toxicities I think of and go through with my patients. I did want to talk specifically about some of the chemotherapy drugs that we do use in this setting of receiving chemotherapy after surgery. And I think Dr. Schiller had mentioned the main drug that is used is a drug called cisplatin, which is spelled C-I-S-P-L-A-T-I-N. And that drug has been the one that's been studied in almost all of the clinical trials done to date looking at adjuvant chemotherapy. And that's the drug that has been involved in the studies that have shown an improvement in survival with the addition of chemotherapy after surgery. And so that drug is the one that we try to use when we can. It does have a couple of additional side effects. It can be difficult on kidney function. And so when we give the drug, we give it with a lot of fluids. On the day that it's given, patients are usually in an infusion area for a good 8 hours, not getting the chemotherapy that whole time, but getting a lot of extra hydration, a lot of fluids. And then they're encouraged to drink a lot of fluids for the several days after chemotherapy. And many patients have to come back in to get those extra fluids, again, through an IV for a couple of days afterwards. So it's important to talk to your doctor about whether or not you're going to need those extra fluids and make arrangements for how to do that. And when we do that, we're able to keep the kidney safe the vast majority of the time. That drug can also have some effects on hearing. And so if, as a patient, you have some hearing issues, hearing difficulty, it's also important to talk about the potential risk from cisplatin. If cisplatin is not an option for a patient, there is a relative of cisplatin called carboplatin, which we feel is almost as effective as the cisplatin, and so it's a reasonable substitute if the cisplatin can't be used, but we do prefer to encourage patients to get the cisplatin if possible. And then, as Dr. Schiller had mentioned, we usually combine that cisplatin with one other drug, and there are a lot of different options to choose from with different side effects. So it's an important discussion for a patient to have with their physician in trying to figure out what would be the best regimen. That's all I wanted to say about the side effects. And now to talk a little bit more about the questions a patient should ask healthcare team about adjuvant treatment and about clinical trials, I wanted to emphasize, as Dr. Schiller did, that until just a few years ago, we didn't know that giving chemotherapy after surgery for early-stage lung cancer could improve the cure rates. And the only reason we know that today is because of hundreds of patients who were willing to participate on clinical trials. And those trials were all looking at either giving chemotherapy or not after surgery and showed us that the chemotherapy was helpful. The next questions, the ones that we're looking at right now, are looking at, can we add treatment to the chemotherapy with these quote-unquote targeted drugs, or are there targeted drugs that maybe we should give instead of chemotherapy for certain patients? And the three largest trials that are going on right now, and again, Dr. Schiller had mentioned these, one of them is looking at a drug called bevacizumab or Avastin. And in that trial, all of the patients get the chemotherapy that we've been talking about. Half of them also get this drug called bevacizumab or Avastin, which we know can help patients who already have a spread of their cancer. We don't know as much about how much it helps people who have had their cancer removed, but we're hoping that it will also add to the chemotherapy, add to the cure. So that's a very important study. Another study is looking at a drug called erlotinib or Tarceva, and that's an oral medication that we know works very well in certain patients who have widespread lung cancer. And again, it's being looked at to see if it can help people whose cancer has already been removed who had early stage disease. So that's another ongoing large trial. And the third really big trial is called the Magritte trial, which is looking at a vaccine targeting a protein that's found in 30 to 40% of patients with early stage lung cancer. So those are the big three studies of treatments that we already know have some effect in patients with more advanced stage disease. And these are all randomized studies where half patients get treated one way and half another to prove whether something's really beneficial or not. Of course, many institutions also have smaller studies, what we call the phase one, phase two, where everyone's getting a particular treatment, trying to get a better sense of whether it might be helpful or not. And those are sort of earlier in development than those big three that we talked about. I think Dr. Schiller had pointed out a really excellent resource that I wanted to highlight again, which is a part of the National Lung Cancer Partnership's website, where they have done an excellent job of putting together a patient education tool which talks about adjuvant trials and what they are, what they're looking at, but also what is adjuvant chemotherapy, what are some of the side effects, what can we do to manage it. And this is a little bit self-promotional because Dr. Schiller and I are featured in this, but I think it's a really nice ongoing resource as well to go back if there are other questions that patients have. And that, again, is on the National Lung Cancer Partnership's website, which is the all one word, nationallungcancerpartnership.org. And then this particular resource is at the .org/early_stage_treatment_info/. And that will bring people to that site. So I think that was most of what I really wanted to talk about. And I think in the question session, we'll be able to have people bring in more specific questions about trials that they might have and also about specific side effects and toxicities that they are concerned about.
Thank you very much, Dr. Wakely. Just a really excellent presentation and just very, very informative and actually very detailed in terms of helping people to understand all the nuances of the treatment, and I really appreciate the detail of your presentation. So thank you very much, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. Our next speaker is Wynn Burkle, and Wynn is an oncology social worker, and he is LiveStrong and National Relations Program Director, and he is the Lung Cancer Program Director for Cancer Care. And Wynn is going to talk to you about the emotional, social, practical, and financial issues that may be dealing with, and also and talk about some of the free services that you can access from Cancer Care. Wynn?
Thank you, Carolyn. You know, I'm sure most of us remember the time we moved into our first new home or even our last new home, and I'm sure most of us wondered how we were ever going to find our way in this new community or neighborhood. And many of us were fortunate enough to get a visit from the welcome wagon or maybe a very helpful new next-door neighbor who helped us find the nearest supermarket, service station, church, school, and all the other services so essential to support our daily life. The more things we were able to connect to in our new neighborhood, the more we felt that we really had things under control. You know, being diagnosed with early-stage lung cancer is, in some ways, very much like moving into a new neighborhood. Our cancer pushes us into a strange and sometimes scary new environment, and we really don't know where anything is and what we can do to get some control over a very difficult change in our lives. Cancer Care, in the role of that good neighbor, provides its popular website, lungcancer.org, to better serve people like you folks. Rather than burden people with heavy medical jargon, lungcancer.org has been designed as a first stop for people who find themselves in this new and strange neighborhood of lung cancer. It's written in a really easy-to-understand language and format and helps patients and those who care for them learn about the basic facts of lung cancer, how it can be prevented, the different types of lung cancer, how lung cancer is screened or detected, the stages of lung cancer, treatments for lung cancer, and the very terms used in talking about lung cancer. And there is a special section on clinical trials, which we've been talking about quite a bit today. And that section not only helps one learn what they're all about, but also provides a very special search tool which can assist in finding the lung cancer clinical trial that best matches each patient's individual situation. And if a patient wishes to become involved in that trial, there is a tool that allows them to connect with a specially trained clinical trial manager to help them with that whole process. In addition, lungcancer.org serves as an easy entrance to connect with the many services which Cancer Care has available free of charge for lung cancer patients and those who care for them. Another thing at services such as education, and certainly one of the primary tools of education are our Connect Education workshops, such as today's workshop, where we can provide specific information on a diagnosis such as early stage lung cancer, as well as dealing with the physical and emotional impacts of early stage lung cancer. Our well-known Cancer Care Connect booklets are available free of charge and are packed with up-to-date information on treatments and the latest coping strategies to help cancer patients and those who care for them. To date, we've distributed approximately 2 million of these very popular publications. And our main website at www.cancercare.org provides a wealth of information on cancer topics and serves as an easy-to-use entry point to Cancer Care's many services, including subscribing to its popular free monthly newsletter. Services, one of our primary services, are the support services that are provided by our professionally trained staff of experienced oncology social workers who are there to assist folks in dealing with the many issues which arise from the diagnosis of early-stage lung cancer. And when you think about this, that early-stage lung cancer is very often found by accident. It's possibly because you were in an accident that they would, in doing a workup for treatment for that, that some evidence is found that there's something going on in the lungs. Or you may be going for some type of elective treatment, which requires pre-op workups. And in that process, something is seen there. And so that the lung cancer is identified at an early stage. Unfortunately, there are no fully approved screening or detection methods for lung cancer at this time, so that accidental discovery when there are no other symptoms is very often a characteristic. And great that it was discovered by accident, but the problem is that it really blindsides us when we felt that we were healthy and just going to handle or deal with something else. And so that piece oftentimes brings folks to Cancer Care to talk about how shocking it is to discover that they're dealing with a diagnosis which can be which certainly is a very serious diagnosis. So Cancer Care social workers can work through and help people kind of understand some methods in accepting this news and how they can proceed in terms of tackling it in manageable bites so that it's not something that overwhelms or interferes with the necessary steps that they need to be taking as far as making treatment choices. Post-surgery, oftentimes, we spend time with folks who are having to make that decision. And the decision is, you know, the surgeon said, I've got it all, and yet here I went for a consult with the oncologist who has indicated that it would be helpful and I should really very seriously consider following up with adjuvant treatment. And it's pretty difficult because there's that sense of, you know, why should I go on this with? And so it's helping people kind of work that through. We're never going to force anyone into making that decision, but we will certainly try and help you make the most informed decision possible, making sure that from our educational resources, you've had the best information possible to make that decision and that you take that decision and sort of inventory your own personal values and priorities and are able to make a decision that you really feel is an informed decision that fits your own life and lifestyle and the things you want to be doing with your life. We also assist with some of the financial issues. And interestingly enough, Cancer Care has a sister organization, the Cancer Care Copay Foundation, which may be able to help people with the cost of treatment medications for the adjuvant treatment. Lung cancer is one of the areas that we have some funding to assist with. We're also able to help with a small grant to help people with some of the costs attendant to treatment, such as taking care of the children or having someone clean the house or paying for a couple of tankfuls of gas to get ourselves to treatment or for the taxi or whatever it is that we need to get there for that treatment. A very practical problem. How do I get there for that treatment? We mentioned earlier the many people or many organizations we collaborate with, and our social workers are very familiar with the resources they offer and can do a very competent resource referral to those many organizations and agencies that are established to help cancer patients. Oftentimes, because we're not dealing with the more conventional later-stage cancer therapy, people sort of look to cancer care social workers to get some sense of, how do I navigate all this? Whom do I speak to first? How should I organize my information? What information do I need to go forward? What questions should I be asking the doctors now that they're talking about going on with this adjuvant treatment? And our social workers are very good at being that sort of that assistant navigator to help with that. Communications issues are very important. Oftentimes when we're trying to make decisions about going forward when we're dealing with early-stage lung cancer and the option of the treatment, the adjuvant treatment, communications with family members, our friends in the community, and also our employers and colleagues in the workplace, sometimes we're going to get a lot of advice, and sometimes people are overwhelmed. And so it's, again, how do I handle all of this information that people are giving me, and how much of it is something I can rely on, and how do I move forward with this? And cancer care social workers can provide our assistance in a variety of friendly settings, such as individual counseling in terms of face-to-face and in the New York Tri-State Metropolitan Area, and as well as nationally on an online and telephone counseling. We have support groups. We have some very active lung cancer support groups in terms of face-to-face and a very popular online cancer patient support group program, as well as telephone support groups. So I think, now that we've had a chance to tell you all that Cancer Care has to offer, we hope that besides being with us today that you will reach out to us by going to our website, www.cancercare.org, or calling us at 1-800-813-813. Hope, H-O-P-E. I'm sure none of us ever expected to find ourselves moved to the neighborhood of early-stage lung cancer, but now that you're here, be assured that Cancer Care, like that good neighbor, is there with you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Wynn. Excellent presentation and just for all the information and help, but also remind everybody that Cancer Care is here for everybody. Thank you so much. And now we have lots of time for questions. I want to thank our speakers for that. We have now a lot of time for questions, and I'm going to have Mary bring all our speakers on board, so we're all here to answer your questions. And then I'm going to ask Mary to explain to you how to queue up for questions, and we're going to take as many of your questions as possible. So let's let the questions begin.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Again, if you do have a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone.
And while we're waiting for our first question, a question that actually comes up a great deal is, how does someone decide about actually making a decision about going on adjuvant therapy? And I wonder if, Dr. Schiller, if you could just say a little bit more about that. Sometimes it's a hard decision for people to decide to do that.
Right. It sure is. And it's where I think one has to balance the potential side effects of chemotherapy versus the potential benefits. And I think that's where one really needs a very close discussion with one's oncologist who can help tell a patient exactly what those benefits and side effects might be. Generally speaking, the tipping point, so to speak, where we say that, yes, the side effects do, the benefits do outweigh the side effects, is often when a tumor is larger. We say 4 centimeters, which is, what, about 2.5 inches, I believe, as well as if the cancer has spread to any lymph nodes. That seems to be where it is. You seem to derive the most benefit from adjuvant chemotherapy. Having said that, other things go into play, and clearly that's a person's health otherwise, as well as potential side effects of treatment of the individual drugs.
Excellent. Thank you very much. And our next question, Mary?
Our next question comes from Cindy N.
Can you hear me?
Yes. Yes, Cindy. Your question.
I have a question regarding, and I'm not sure if I missed it if I came in late. What if you're having, if you went in and just say, like you mentioned, that you might have come across it by an accident that you went in and they saw something. I have a friend of mine that's gone through basically that, but they haven't really gone the next step to try to go in and see if she really has lung cancer. So I just wondered if you could give some insight to say if someone's had like a PT scan and they've shown potentially some lesions there or whatever, you know, what's the next step? Like, if what advice would you give to someone to say, okay, this is what you do to get diagnosed? Because I think that's such a complex thing that I'm hearing right now to do to get that.
Well, that's an excellent question, Cindy. I'm so glad you asked it, and you're a good friend, it sounds like. So we're going to see. I'm going to actually ask all our speakers to weigh in on this one. I'm going to ask if Dr. Schiller could start, then Dr. Wakely, and I'm going to ask Gwynne also to comment on this as well, because this is really it's complicated for many people.
Sure, and it's also very timely and topical right now. It is a slightly different question than the question about whether or not to do adjuvant therapy, though. It is a question more about diagnosis. And we see this happen a lot, more and more, as people are getting CAT scans for unrelated reasons, as well as the fact that our CAT scans are getting better and better, and they are getting more and more sensitive. We are learning that they can pick up a lot of little stuff that we never knew was there before. So as these CAT scans get really, really good, we're seeing and identifying lots of little ditzels. That's literally what we call them, little marks on the CAT scan, that sometimes we don't know what to do about because they are so small. And in many cases, we think that they may not be cancer at all. They may be old scar tissue, for example. So doctors right now, are learning with what to do with these very small lesions, whether or not to just continue to follow them. And if they start to grow, that's the time to intervene or not. And often what we use to help make that decision and make that recommendation is literally what it looks like on that CAT scan. We are learning more and more as time goes on which of these are more likely to turn out to be cancer than not. And in some cases, these little things often look relatively benign and are probably safe to watch, and making sure that they don't grow, of course. They would need very careful observation to make sure they don't grow. Heather, what did you think?
I don't think I have much to add to that. I mean, there are so many different things that can show up on a CAT scan, and so there are algorithms that are being developed to help the pulmonologists, who are usually the ones initially involved at that stage, in deciding, is this something we need to biopsy now, or is this something that we can wait and get a repeat CAT scan on in either 3, 6, 12 months, depending on what it looks like. And so those are really the next steps, is to meet with there are certain pulmonologists who specialize in these sort of what they call pulmonary nodule clinics, people who work in the setting of what could this nodule be and what do we need to do to make sure we don't miss a cancer without subjecting people to biopsies they don't need. And we are learning more and more, as Dr. Schiller said, with some ongoing studies.
Now, are these clinics usually in comprehensive cancer centers, or are they in other hospitals as well, or is this something that ought to be followed? Can you say a bit about where the person might want to consider going for the careful monitoring?
Well, we have one in our cancer center, but I also know that there are community sites that have these sort of pulmonary nodule clinics as well, and so it's going to depend a lot on where this particular person is. Mm-hmm. And it's something that their primary care physician should be able to help them find.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. And Wynne, do you just want to comment on just the emotional and social upheaval that this could cause?
Yeah, and I just wanted to, you know, I think it's been very helpful, Cindy, that our two doctors, you know, have said, I think, helped point out that, you know, just because it's something in the lung doesn't mean necessarily that it's going to be lung cancer. But the other thing is that we've found that, you know, pushing someone about, well, you've got to follow, doesn't work terribly well. But sometimes just kind of gently exploring what the resistance is all about, what the piece about not wanting to go forward can be helpful and can oftentimes help them kind of get around that and say, yeah, well, maybe I can go ahead and take care of that. So that's one of the techniques that our social workers use, but we don't have any copyright on it. It might be something that a good friend could use as well.
Well, that sounds like a good piece of advice. So you're right, though. It encourage your friend probably to see their primary care doctor and to kind of help get perhaps one of these the specialty clinics that would be able to monitor this, and then move on, you know, and feel that they're doing everything that they can. So that's really very important.
Carolyn, can I add one more thing?
Yes.
And that is I do want to reassure the listeners that in many cases, if these spots on these CT scans are indeed very small, that it is often safe to wait and watch, so to speak. When they're very, very small like that, they don't grow very quickly. The other thing is that there are a lot of benign lesions, and what you have to weigh against this is the risk of actually having a biopsy, because unlike maybe a mammogram, for example, where the tumor is much closer to the surface of the skin, these small spots in the lungs are much more difficult to biopsy, and have the side effects of biopsies are also significantly greater. So they're not easy to biopsy.
So to really have a very thoughtful discussion with one's healthcare team as to what the benefits and risks are here. Is that what you were suggesting, Dr. Schiller?
Yes, right. Mm-hmm.
Okay, excellent. Well, these are really excellent questions. Thank you, Cindy, and thanks for being such a good friend and such a helpful one. Okay, our next question.
Our next question comes from Robert S.
Yeah, hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, very well. Yes, Robert.
Good, good. I had heard a lot of pros and cons concerning utilizing antioxidants during chemotherapy, which I'm going through right now, a little bit different than what you're talking about. But that's my main question. I've heard that during the time you do go through chemotherapy, you shouldn't be taking things like grapeseed extract, lycopene, IP6, which I had done about 10 or 12 years ago with another lung cancer. And so I'm going through a second one right now, and again, have heard pros and cons, and I'm just curious to know what your response might be to that.
That's an excellent question. It's one that certainly comes up a lot on our programs. And Dr. Schiller and Dr. Wakely, would you like to both comment on that?
Sure. This is Dr. Wakely. That's always a difficult question because we don't have a lot of information to really answer that in an informed way. We do know that some of the antioxidants can theoretically interfere with the way that the chemotherapy is functioning, and so that is why we tend to discourage people from taking high doses of supplements. I do encourage people to continue taking a multivitamin if they do so. If it happens to have vitamin C, vitamin E, that's fine. With some of the other supplements, though, it's harder to know, and unfortunately, some of them also have additional toxicities, particularly in the liver, which tend to be mild, but at the same time that we're giving chemotherapy, we get concerned about interactions. And so what I tend to tell my patients is to let me know what it is that you're thinking of taking. We look at it together. And decide. Most of the time, though, I do encourage people to just hold out during those 3 months that we're going to be giving active chemotherapy and not to be taking anything extra. But then, depending on what it is and on the patient, we usually will then start back on something after the treatment's completed.
Excellent. Thank you. And Dr. Schiller?
I would agree entirely with everything that Dr. Wakely just said. I would also add that in addition to everything she just said, sometimes some of the extracts or herbal supplements we're not real necessarily sure what is in them. They're not purified, and we're not exactly sure which herbs, which antioxidants, or what other things are in there that may or may not influence how the chemotherapy is going to work.
Excellent. And we have a question from someone online in terms of just the whole concept of clinical trials. Just a little more detail about the phases of trials and exactly how they work. And so, Dr. Wakely, could you say a bit more about that?
Sure, I'd be happy to. And let me take that in two parts. So, first of all, as a general question about clinical trials, with a phase one trial, that tends to be either a new drug or a new combination. And we tend to enroll people sort of a few at a time. So we put a few on at a certain dose and see how people tolerate it. Then we try a slightly different dose and just with a few people to make sure that they tolerate it and sort of take a stepwise approach until we get to a dose that we feel is safe and seems like it might work. In the phase one studies, because patients with often many different types of cancer can go on, it's often very hard for us to know how well a drug is working. And the main questions are, can we find the dose that seems to be the right dose? When we're dealing with a phase two study, we're looking to see if the drug or combinations of drugs, now that we know the safe dose, does it seem to work? If we give it to patients with a particular disease, usually restricted to either a particular stage of disease or who've only had one or two different types of treatment in the past, is there any hint that this drug is or combination is helpful? In the phase three, we're looking at treatments, either combinations or drugs, that have already looked promising in phase two, and we're really putting them to the test. So in phase three, we're comparing this new treatment to the standard of care treatment. And it's only by doing that sort of a test that we're able to prove whether something really is better. We've unfortunately many times been fooled in phase two where a drug where you're giving that treatment to lots of people, everybody's getting the treatment, looks like everyone does well, and we find out that we just selected people who were going to do well anyway and it wasn't actually the treatment that helped them get better, and that's why we need these randomized phase three trials. We're in a setting such as early stage lung cancer where we're trying to cure people. We're clearly not looking in that setting with these newest drugs where we don't know anything about them and don't know the dose. Those tend to be reserved for patients who have more advanced stages of cancer where maybe they don't have a next treatment that they can try. That's when those treatments come into play, those phase one. So in early stage cancer, when we're trying to cure, we're really only doing trials with the drugs that we know how to give them. We have a good sense of whether or not they might be helpful, and we're really putting them to the test, comparing them to the standard of care. And that's why the focus of the trials that Dr. Schiller and I spoke about today were primarily phase three studies. Hopefully that answers the question.
Thank you very much.
I was just going to also add to that if I could.
Yes, please.
And that is, I guess I'd like to just kind of put in a little plug here for going on clinical studies. There's lots of reasons people may or may not decide to go on clinical studies. One thing I think, though, is that most of the literature has definitely shown that, in general, patients do better if they're on a study. If for no other reason than because they're watched and observed much more thoroughly. The second thing is going on clinical studies is really the only way we make progress in cancer. All of the drugs that we now have were developed because patients went on clinical studies. In the United States, less than 10% of all cancer patients go on clinical studies, and for lung cancer, it's less than 5%. And as Dr. Wakely mentioned, we have so many exciting new drugs out there. Just imagine if we could start to study them all quickly. When it comes to breast cancer, tens of thousands of breast cancer patients go on study each year. When it comes to lung cancer in the United States, it's less than 5,000 each year. And so our progress, I think, is significantly lessened by getting the number of patients who agree to go on study. And the last thing I would just like to say is that the National Lung Cancer Partnership just has an excellent, excellent video on clinical trials, which can be obtained free of charge. And I can order it by just going to the website.
Excellent. Thank you. And we have another question, I believe. Yes, Mary?
Our next question comes from Karen T.
Yes, I have a question for Dr. Wakely. She had spoken about the target drugs. Could I have a spelling of those target drugs, please?
Oh, sure, sorry about that. So bevacizumab is B-E-V-A-C-I-Z-U-M-A-B. Erlotinib is E-R-L-O-T-I-N-I-B. And again, I think if you go to the Cancer Care Connect website or to the National Lung Cancer Partnership website, those two that we had spoken about, you'll be able to find a lot more information about those and the trials as well.
Excellent. Well, this has been a really very excellent program and just very informative. I actually want to ask both Dr. Schiller and Dr. Wakely if you could just comment in summing up what you see as being new on the horizon in the treatment of early-stage lung cancer. Anything you'd like to comment to the audience?
I guess my thoughts would be that as we start to develop more and more of these quote-unquote targeted therapies, meaning therapies that are designed to target processes specific for cancer that don't happen in normal tissues, as we start to develop more and more of these, I think we're going to see more and more of these go into clinical trials and hopefully make it into common usage. And I think that's where our big advances are going to come for early stage lung cancer as well as later cancers as well.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Wakely?
So, again, I think the future are the trials that are ongoing now, and there are other trials ongoing as well that we didn't talk about as much that are trying to more personalize treatment. So the trials we focused on are looking at new drugs, many of which we are able to get a sense ahead of time of which patients might be better helped by those newer drugs. We're also there are also trials ongoing, many of them in Europe, looking at how to select the right people for the specific chemotherapy drugs as well. And so I think as long as we're able to complete these trials, that we should in another 5 or 10 years be in a situation where when a patient is diagnosed with early stage lung cancer and goes to see an oncologist, the oncologist will be able to say, based on an analysis of the tumor that was taken out, we think these are the drugs most likely to help you. Now, we're not there yet, and we'll only get there if we can get people to participate in clinical trials, but I think we're very, very hopeful that that's where we're going to be.
Excellent. Well, I have to say this has been an extraordinary conference call. I actually want to thank all of our speakers for just really being incredibly wonderful speakers and very informative. I want to thank all of you who've queued up and asked such excellent questions. You know, I know you asked the questions to get information for yourself or someone you care about or love. However, in asking your question, you end up really helping us to enhance the call because it allows our speakers to address some additional issues. I also want to thank all of you who have been listening, and I want to remind you this is a one-hour program and that we want you to be sure to know that there are lots of services that you can access when this program ends. If you have a question and didn't get to ask it, please call Cancer Care after the program. If there's a concern you have, if you would like some of our support services from Cancer Care, please just give us a call as well. And you have lots of information about the National Lung Cancer Partnership website. That's a wonderful place to go to in terms of some additional information, lungcancer.org and Cancer Care. You have a lot of information in your materials about all of the different resources that you can access. Most importantly, as we conclude our program today, I do not want anyone to feel that you're alone in coping with lung cancer or with coping with your concerns. I want you to now feel that you're part of a community of support and that there are lots of resources out there to help you and people and well-trained professionals that are here to provide you the help that you need to get on with your life. So I want to thank you very much for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may now disconnect and have a wonderful day.